This is Eleanor Swin interviewing Vincent Perry on March 9th, 1990 in Carmel. When we stopped yesterday, you were just about to leave Cananea. And another thing, and we forgot a couple of things that we might want to fill in today.
Let's start about 1935, during the last part of my stay in Cananea. Increasingly, efforts were directed to doing outside examinations, both in the United States and in Mexico. In 1935, there was the first of a series of serious labor conflicts, and the mines at Cananea were shut down. All the Americans were told to leave camp because of the uncertainties of the situation and the dangers to families. I took my wife and daughter to Berkeley to be with my sisters. And I asked Reno Sales in Butte to give me some assignment that would keep me busy during that strike period. He had certain examination jobs scheduled, and he asked me to join Frank Cameron, who was then doing outside exploration work for Anaconda in Alaska, with headquarters in Seattle. Frank had an assistant, Harry Townsend, who also had helped in this work. Cameron came down to Berkeley. We met up on the Mother Lode, and we made several more or less routine examinations along the Mother Lode without finding anything that we thought was attractive enough to recommend to the company. We then visited some of the gold areas in the Mojave Desert and in northwestern Arizona. And about that time, I received word from Mr. Weed that it looked as though the Cananea labor situation was going to be settled, but he didn't know just when the operation would get back in full scale. So he suggested that we move back to Cananea, which my wife did with some reluctance because she was still concerned about the safety of our little daughter. I undertook some work in Sinaloa. We had information about some of those properties in the Sierra close to the Durango line, and I took equipment down there and did geological mapping and sampling. While I was there,
remember and the names of any of those places?
I don't recall their names now. But I was informed passing through Mazatlan that the single most important property operating successfully in that area was the San Luis Company at Tayoltita. It happened that I had been a classmate of Larry Morrell, who was, I believe, mine superintendent at the time at Tayoltita. And so I got in touch with him and arranged a visit to the mine. It was a real thriller for me because I had never gone into that rough country on an airplane, and the flight into that the narrow canyon and the landing on the tailings dump was something to really impress the outside visitor. I met the manager at the mine, at the mill, and arrangements were made to take to go on muleback up to the mine, where I arrived about midday. Larry immediately got me underground because I told him I had to be back in Mazatlan the following morning. And we had a great trip through the mine. It was the first time I'd ever seen a really rich silver property. And to this day, I remember going in one of those big shrinkage stopes. The ground was hard, and there was no timber to interfere with the geologists' views. You could look along the back of that stope as far as your light would flash, across widths of probably 10 to 30 feet. And this quartz vein was simply ribbed with reddish traces of the very high-grade silver, ruby-silver mineral. And I couldn't believe that anybody could be so lucky to have such a rich mine right there at their fingertips and able to knock it down with such great ease. We had a wonderful visit through the mine and got out about 6 o'clock in the evening and found that Larry's wife had already cooked up a big party for that night, and so we spent the rest of the night celebrating. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I reminded Larry that I had to make the plane out of Tailteta at around 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and he'd better get me down over that trail. He got a couple of mules. Phil Chase, one of the Tailteta geologists, was there, and he said he'd go down with me. And they practically strapped us on the mules, and we started down that dark black trail, largely depending upon the intelligence of the mules to get us to where we wanted to go. We arrived in time and took the plane, and I guess the thrill of taking off from that tailing pile was about the same as the juvenile flyer has when he makes his first trip off the deck of an aircraft carrier. You reach the end of the tailing pile before you were airborne, and as the wheels touched off from the embankment of the tailings, the plane would sag down into the canyon, and I wondered whether it was ever going to catch enough air to actually move, which it certainly did. They were very skillful pilots, and they maneuvered out of there without any difficulty at all. But it was a thrill to me.
Do you happen to remember what kind of plane they were using at that time?
I believe it was a tri-motor Ford. Ford Fokker plane, I believe. Okay. That, yeah. Okay. But I may be wrong about that, but I believe that was it. It was a rather large plane, I thought, for that kind of use. But it did carry cargo, and probably the mine needed that sort of transportation facility to handle the kind of loads that went in there. Mm-hmm. It was certainly more than just a passenger plane. Yeah. But it was a real thrill, and it colored my judgment a bit when I subsequently looked at other properties along the same mineral belt in southeastern Sinaloa, and wondered whether any of them would be rich enough and productive enough to stand the sort of capital investments that were required to originally start the San Luis operation.
Yes.
That was an exceptional bonanza, and I don't think anything like it has been found in that same area.
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet, no. Well, it must have been very evident to the early day prospectors, and it again reflects the intelligence and skill of the Hearst interests in those early days, when they could move around the country and pick up a bonanza like San Luis in Mexico, and in the same period have a representative in Utah discovering and developing the very rich Ontario vein, and then moving on to lead South Dakota and becoming interested in homestake, and not satisfied with that, making financial arrangements that put them in control of the Anaconda operations in Butte. They were a very smart, well-organized mining group. Very aggressive, intelligent men. Their motivation, of course, was to own everything that was rich and good in the newly opened up West. And they pretty nearly succeeded.
Yes. So then you went.
Well, then because of that very uncertain labor situation in Cananea, there was discontent among some of the American employees about staying on in Cananea, and some of them actually took their families, or at least stayed in Cananea on a bachelor status, and moved their families out to Southern California. Margaret and I talked this over, and about that time I had an opportunity to discuss it with Reno Sales, and Sales said that he was perfectly willing to support an outside geological office in the United States, and have me continue the work that I had just started as an assistant to Harry Townsend and to Frank Cameron in the States. I asked him where he suggested I make my headquarters, and he said, "You just pick your place." He said, "Pick a place where you and your wife and child will be comfortable, and give your daughter a chance to get a good education." The education problem was one that all of us were concerned with, because Cananea offered only a limited opportunity. The company supported a Anglo-American school, and it was well staffed with competent teachers, but was restricted to the first grades, and there certainly was no chance to continue into late grammar school or high school. So joined with several other Cananea families in deciding that the best place to go is the Los Angeles area. I suppose there was a touch of glamour involved in it, but Hollywood seemed to be the preferred spot, and we found an apartment on Hayworth, close to Hollywood Boulevard, and not far from the domicile of Dr. Hoagland's wife, who had been a friend of ours in Cananea and who had brought her daughter out to be educated. She had established a place at Westwood. Mrs. Kirk had her daughter there, and she was in Beverly Hills. Mrs. Gibbs, the wife of the American consul in Cananea, had her daughter out and in Hollywood. And the Green family, who the father of the husband of Mrs. Wiswell, who had remarried, was living on the intersection of Hollywood Boulevard and Hayworth. So it was a nice neighborhood to be in, and my wife was going to, I could see, would be very happy there with a friend she had already made in Cananea. And there was an excellent school within a block. It was a parochial school, St. Ambrose. So we started our daughter in school there, and I took off for the desert and left my family there. And we were separated a good part of the time because I was in the field almost entirely for the next 2 years. I started work on prospects that I had read about in Arizona. And one of the sources of information that was most valuable was a series of reports that had been written by two mine geologists named Beckwith and Spilsbury, who had worked for the Inspiration Consolidated Copper Company. Because of the interrelation through Anaconda of Inspiration and Cananea, we had access to those reports. And Roland Mulkey, my assistant, made a thorough analysis of all of the material that was available in that file, and picked out several that sounded rather interesting. One of Mulkey's guide points, and I think it was an excellent one, was that any of the reports that in the Arizona desert that showed some evidence of contact metamorphic mineralization in limestone would be something to investigate, because the contact zones produced hard garnet, which weathered with differentially and produced the outcrops, and around those outcrops the softer porphyries or volcanic or sedimentary rocks would generally erode, so that it was likely that if there were mineralized zones of which the contact metamorphic part outcropped, that associated with those would be areas of more widespread mineralization that would be hidden by gravel cover because they were soft and had eroded more readily. We used that as a general field guide and looked at several of those occurrences. One of them was the district immediately south of Tucson, Mineral Hill, Helvetia, and the Twin Buttes. I actually optioned ground there and did a small amount of drilling, but did not find anything that at that moment appeared important enough to go ahead and develop. It was probably a case of not following through aggressively, and part of it was the fact that we were limited as to the amount of money we could spend. In these days of multi-million dollar budgets, it's rather naive to reflect back that our budgets usually were in the order of $10,000 or $15,000. And when we couldn't produce an ore body with one or two drill holes, it was time for us to move on to some other locality. If we had stayed with that area, I feel confident we would have discovered then what later became a very important development after United Geophysical had hit a small high-grade ore body at Mineral Hill and had acquired a lot of surrounding ground, which attracted the competition of several major companies, including the American Smelting and Refining Company, Cyprus, and others. Of course, we knew, and this was 20 years after our early efforts there, that there were other extensive possibilities, and so capitalizing on at least that old information, we were able to secure for Anaconda a large part of the area, which embraced the old Twin Buttes mine. Again, small, isolated contact metamorphic showings that outcropped through the desert wash, but around which there was widespread low-grade mineralization in sedimentary rocks and in porphyry intrusions. And this was the basis for the opening up of the Twin Buttes open pits and also the development by Texas Gulf Sulphur, I believe, of the Sierrita mines.
These were going back to copper.
These were going back to copper,
yeah. We had been looking for gold.
We had been looking for gold because the price of gold had been moved by the Roosevelt administration from $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce. Mm-hmm. But about we approached the end of the 30s, it became increasingly evident that trouble was brewing in Europe. And the economic interest in metals began to swing away from the precious metals to the base metals because of economic conditions, the fact that this was reflected in increased prices for the various base metals, particularly copper.
Now, this sort of judgment, where was this made? In the head office and then?
No, I don't think so. I think the company was so preoccupied with their situation in Chile and the fact that they had acquired these tremendous reserves at Chuquicamata and felt that if there was going to be, and I'm quite sure they anticipated, a strong copper market, that they had enough copper in Chile to satisfy any conceivable demand that would be put upon them, particularly since they owned the American Brass Company and the Anaconda Wire and Cable Company and two of the largest consumers of metal in the United States. So that my very minuscule efforts were in the Southwest were pretty much ignored. I was simply on my own, and I think I had the sympathy and attention of my immediate superior, Reno Sales, but I think his position of authority as far as determining company policy was restricted too.
So you could look for any metal that you wanted to look for?
Yes, and I was on my own, and I was following that dictum, just go out and find a mine. And of course I was looking for things as rich as San Luis, a mine in Sinaloa, that type of thing, and they are not easy to find.
No. Did you have any chance to argue for one of these finds? I know you were disappointed.
No, I was very much disappointed, and no, I didn't have an opportunity to express myself. An example of this is the situation around Morenci. Connection with my studies of the Southwest generally, I was very much impressed with the great Morenci district, and I knew that Phelps Dodge was supposed to own the whole district. However, as a matter of curiosity, I went around the outskirts of the district, and I was surprised to note that there was a lot of ground that Phelps Dodge did not own. So on my own, I made arrangements with a property owner, I believe his name was Cook, but I'm not sure of that name, who had a large tract of ground covering the west part of Morenci. And in my reconnaissance, I also noted an unusual breccia pipe outcrop immediately adjoining where I could see Phelps Dodge had done their drilling to define the clay ore body, which is presently the principal or one of the principal sources of production of the Phelps Dodge company. I visited the county clerk's office, and looking at the property maps, I found out that this beautifully mineralized outcrop was not owned by Phelps Dodge, that it was owned by an individual whose name was in the phone book. And I looked him up, and he told me, yes, he said, I own this ground. I said, well, who do you work for? And he said, well, he said, I am an employee of Phelps Dodge. I am a clerk in their office. And I said, well, why hasn't Phelps Dodge purchased this ground from you? He said, they're probably holding out to get it for nothing. I said, well, would you be willing to talk to me tomorrow morning about it? And he said, oh, yes, I'd be glad to. So after a very brief talk, I convinced him that for a few hundred dollars, I'd get an option on the ground, and we hired an attorney. The expenses for the attorney coming out of my limited $200 expense account, and I had this thing tied up for Anaconda. I was delighted to have made such a find, and I thought that maybe here I had something that pardon me, we could start working right from the surface.
Reno Sales came down at my request and to see this new development, and He expressed some chagrin and said he'd have to find out, get some instructions from New York. He called Cornelius Kelly on the phone and told him that one of the Anaconda geologists had located a large block of ground that showed interesting mineralization adjoining the large developments that Phelps Dodge had been making recently in that same area, where Phelps Dodge was planning a major new investment. Kelly was rather shocked at this news and said, I'm sorry, Reno, but I'm afraid we can't follow this. He said, I've already made a commitment. He said that puts Anaconda in a very difficult position. I have an agreement worked out with Mr. Cates, who was chairman of the board of Phelps Dodge at the time, by which Anaconda would provide all the engineering services to Phelps Dodge to design and build a major new facility, including the concentrator and smelter for the Morenci project. He said it would be certainly inconsistent for Anaconda to move in competitively and try to pick up mineral ground after already making a business arrangement and a contract with Phelps Dodge to help them in exploitation of their Morenci deposit. The net result was that I turned the options back to these landowners, and Phelps Dodge, of course, has since acquired all that land, and it's now part of the big Morenci open pit.
That's must have been a big disappointment to you.
Well, it was a terrible disappointment, and I thought maybe I should be a little less aggressive in moving in before I had checked with my superiors and found out what company policy was. The next move I made, though, that again put me at cross purposes with the policy in the New York office was to examine and recommend three large separate deposits, the Castle Dome near Globe, Miami, the Louis D'Or in the same general district, and the Baghdad deposits. These all had evidence of extensive low-grade copper mineralization outcropping at the surface. They had done some drilling had been done by promoters and owners, enough so that in my judgment it looked as though they had the makings of future mines. I'd
reported favorably on them. And again, the New York office turned me down on the basis that material of such low grade was not attractive to Anaconda. And I suppose their judgment at the time was a reasonable one, because they were opening up such beautiful large deposits in Chile, specifically Puerto Rios and Chuquicamata, that these 6 7/10 copper grades that I was talking about simply didn't look as though they measured up competitively with the kind of things that were available in Chile. So I was turned down there, and I continued with my efforts and found a very interesting low-grade extension of the old Silver Bell district, which was located west of Tucson, fairly close to the Ajo mine of Phelps Dodge.
Excuse me, may I ask just one question? You had mentioned limestone. Was this the first time that you've been working in limestone?
No. There was, in fact, the limestone is a very important part of the geology of the Cananea district. So I was familiar with limestone, and this is well, the Cananea was a beautiful type locality for all these things, because we had a limestone rock background with a sedimentary section of which the limestone was a part. And then that was all covered unconformably by volcanic rocks. And these volcanic rocks, in turn, were penetrated by deep-seated intrusives, including a series of the significant quartz porphyry plugs. And I could see in that sequence at Cananea the general pattern that exists in so many of the big copper districts of the Western Hemisphere.
Is there limestone at Butte also?
There is no limestone in Butte. Butte has a granite wall rock, but again, it has the quartz porphyry intrusives, and it's those quartz porphyry intrusives which are the genetic keys to the copper mineralization. But the limestone occurrences where they were affected by contact metamorphism, by the intrusive and mineralizing effects related to the overall mineralization process, provided a surface indicator of a center of mineralization.
So now let's go back to Silver Bell. I'm sorry.
Well, Silver Bell was another of these occurrences with a contact metamorphic zone, and we found extensive mineralization in porphyritic rocks away from the limestone center. I recommended this to the company, and because I have found out that the ownership was in the hands of a group in Boston, and I hope that through financial or personal contacts that our people in Boston knew enough about the
mining circle. Our people in New York knew enough about the mining group in Boston so that they could tie up all the ground that I was recommending. while this was being considered, word came to me that the American Smelting and Refining Company, which owned the small contact metamorphic part of the district, had apparently gotten word of my interest and activities in trying to tie up the whole district, and they, while New York and Boston were considering what to do about my proposal, they had acquired all the ground that I was interested in. So American Smelting and Refining Company has one of their big operations there at the present time. It's one of their big mines. But again, I lost out. And in reflecting on these things, it's evident now that my efforts were not properly coordinated with the overall company direction from the head office in New York City. I was simply a member of the geological organization well down the ladder who was given an order and I assume was not expected to find very much, but at least was given a chance to go out and look the country over. I had made enough of an imprint upon some of them to know that I had done something useful at Cananea and had some ideas, and let this young fellow roam around a bit and see what he comes up with. But this isn't the way to find mines. The way to find mines is to have an organization, to have a team, to have some legal help, to have men that are competent to go out and negotiate for properties, and to have operators then that can come in and do the necessary drilling and underground development to determine whether there is enough ore there to justify the large capital investment required to make a mine. And in those days of the 30s, we didn't have that. What Anaconda did have was that kind of an approach, but it was concentrated entirely upon Chile and the fact that they had made their big, or had already committed themselves to their big investment in Chile. And there was nothing wrong with that at all, except for one underlying long-range fallacy, and that was that there was an overriding political problem which they had hoped would never come to a head, and that a communist such as Allende and his group would never take over the reins of government in a foreign country where they had all this investment. And this, in a way, was short-sighted because it didn't provide for that. We should have been looking for the kind of low-grade deposits in the United States that would have at least sustained a small operations, but a property position, so that when the time came that reserves of that kind could be considered economic and usable, that Anaconda would have been in a position to have exploited them. We didn't.
Of course, even before Allende, the war must have.
The war did, of course, was very important in the sense that there were
shipments easily.
The shipments were under a certain amount of hazard because of submarine activity, but the U.S. government was completely aware of the strategic importance of Chilean copper, and they maintained military establishments along that west coast and certainly through the Panama Canal, so that there were no incidents of actual conflict that interrupted the flow of copper. There were periods when supplies of copper built up on the docks at Antofagasta, where shipments couldn't be made. One of the first trips I made to Chile in 1944, and I saw it firsthand what two or three city blocks of copper ingot looked like, stacked up one on top of the other as far as the eye could see. They were shipments that were being held up temporarily, probably because of fear of German submarines. But the copper generally moved and was received in the plants in Connecticut and other places in eastern United States and fabricated into war materials or whatever use that, to which the copper was designed.
Still have you in Los Angeles, though.
Well, after these frustrating experiences, which I have been relating, which occupied a period of about 2 years, Sales himself decided that something had to be done to establish a better rapport between exploration effort in the United States and the overall policy of the New York office, which was focused almost entirely on developments in Chile. So he suggested that I move and become part of the Salt Lake City organization, which had existed for some time, but which was used primarily as a means of developing a supply of metal, principally lead and zinc, for the Tooele plant. The Tooele plant at Salt Lake City was owned by Anaconda and had a lead zinc unit and also a copper smelter. And
this was a refining plant.
No, this was a smelting plant, not a refining plant. It was a smelter and a lead smelter, a zinc concentrator, and a copper smelter.
And were there mines?
And there were, well, they were mostly, it was mostly custom ore, although the Anaconda Company did have some small properties which were served by the metallurgical facilities at Tooele. One of the most important was the Mountain City Copper Company, and I suppose the event that precipitated my removal from Los Angeles to Salt Lake was the assignment to carefully map a newly discovered high-grade copper deposit at Mountain City. This was an extremely interesting, unique thing. It was found in the old Mountain City district, which was a gold camp, by a practical prospector named Hunt. Frank Hunt had spent his life looking for mines in Nevada, and towards the end of his life had found what he thought was a really attractive outcrop in the Mountain City District. It was a gossan about 50 to 100 feet wide and approximately 3,000 or 4,000 feet long that contained, in addition to the iron oxide, a lot of quartz. There were no particular values in the gossan. It was a thoroughly leached affair, but Hunt correctly surmised, with only his own practical experience, no technical knowledge at all, that underneath such a gossan there could be an enriched copper zone. And he worked around the old drainage at Mountain City and decided where the water table should be. And in the winter of 1937, set out to sink winze with a partner 208 feet to his projected water table. How he ever sunk that winze in the dead of winter with the below temperature reaching down to 30 and 40 below zero, I don't know. It said that he kept a good supply of whiskey on hand and that that fueled his efforts to get that winds down. At any rate, by spring, he had reached the projected 207 feet, and at 208 feet, this barren gossan went into massive high-grade copper ore.
Just where
he said it was going to be.
Wow.
He came into Salt Lake City. He had met Reno Sales, and he said of all, he didn't have much use for geologists, but he said Reno Sales was the exception. There was one geologist who really understood geology, and he wanted to show him his sample. So Reno Sales happened to be in Salt Lake City at the time, and he had a nice friendly talk with Hunt, and Hunt invited him to come out and see the development. Sales made the trip out in a wagon from Elko, distance of about 100 miles, and he confirmed the fact that across a width of about 50 feet, his lowest sample ran 38% copper.
Oh, my.
So a deal was made with the Hunt. He was paid a sum of money, and he turned over the whole thing to Anaconda. And Anaconda operated that successfully then for several years, and I was asked to come up there while the development was going on and mapped the geology, and it was an interesting and stimulating job, and then took me away from the phobias that began to develop looking at 6/10 and 7/10 disseminated copper in sub-economic porphyries in Arizona. So Sales said, why don't you just move the family up to Salt Lake City? It's a nice place to live and work out of there. I think that was an excellent suggestion, and I moved in September 1939 and established my headquarters in Salt Lake City. It was necessary for me to work in as part of the organization there that already existed, and I did that without creating any great personnel problems, and
for what was your title?
Well, for a while I didn't have any title, and then finally, when Tom Lyon, who was chief geologist of the International Smelting and Refining Company, retired, they gave me his title, and I had that for a few years, and then Reno Sales retired, and they gave me the title of Chief Geologist of the Anaconda Company. And so I maintained my headquarters in Salt Lake City, and about that time, New York decided that I should have my headquarters in New York City, and I politely refused to go back to New York because I didn't want to have any part of living in a great big overwhelming metropolis when I had such a delightful sight in Salt Lake City with many friends and out west and in a place where the mines are and where I felt I could really do something useful. This struggle went on for from 1949 to 1956. In the meantime, the problems in South America became more and more acute, and I was called upon to go down to South America periodically, and Mr. Weed, who had by then become chief executive officer of the company and who had been my manager at Cananea, said, "Vin, you just have to get back here to New York. If we're going to have an organization that functions together and that where the mine operators and the operating and mining department, the geological group and the explorationists can all intermingle and integrate their activities." After much deliberation, we decided we just had to go back, and we did that reluctantly in 1956. Mm-hmm. But that was really a move which I didn't like to make, and there are regrets to this day that I couldn't just stay out here in the West where I really belonged and where I felt I could do some good. I was certainly not cut out to be a financial man or a New York administrator or executive. I felt much more at home with the mining people in the West and with the opportunity to get out and be in the mines and around mining men, where I felt I had some understanding and sympathetic friends that would be helpful when I needed them.
So you were in Salt Lake for 17 years.
We were in Salt Lake for 17 years, of 39 to through 56, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you first went there, you were just in charge of exploration in the States?
That was about the size of it, yes. Oh. Without any particular title, I was just the exploration geologist, and the whole thing was an informal effort. There was no organized group. I did my job, and when I needed geological help, I would call upon one or more of the operating geologists, usually in Salt Lake City, or if I needed them in Butte. One of the things that I did try to do was set up some branch offices after our efforts became more formalized. One of them particularly was the office in Reno, Nevada. I staffed that with Bob Mailman, who was a Butte geologist that had received his doctor's degree at Harvard, and a very competent scientist. He was helpful as an assistant on two projects. One, the Mountain City development, which was initiated about that time. We took over the entire Mountain City district, where there had been some very interesting copper discoveries made and also some gold showings, and built a small mill at Mountain City. The other important development, and what proved to be a very major development in later years, was the exploration at Yerington, Nevada, south of Reno. Yerington was an old district, had been developed by Thompson of the Newmont Company, and he had built a smelter there. But somewhere during the early part of the century, the whole operation had come to an end, and the smelter had been dismantled. Sales told me something about the history of that development, because he had made a trip there in those early days, and he said, Ben, you ought to look that situation over very carefully, because he said, in my opinion, there are geological indications there that there may be something much more important than anything that was found by Thompson and Newmont. And so I made a cursory examination and then asked Mailman to map the whole district in detail. Mailman's mapping revealed a very important thing, that while a large part of the area extending from the Walker River up to the Sengatsi Range, a distance of about 2 miles, was covered completely by alluvial fans, that poking out at one point beyond the edge of the alluvial fan, there was a very interesting outcrop of quartz porphyry, well mineralized with copper oxides. And surface samples taken by Mailman showed that these outcrops ran between 1% and 2% copper. We studied this particular showing in relation to the geology of the whole area, and came to the conclusion that there was a very good chance that you could project this showing under the gravel. So we picked a site several hundred feet from the original outcrop and drilled through the gravel. And our first hole made an important discovery of 2% copper sulfide mineralization immediately below a thin layer of oxide material. I, of course, was excited about the grade, and I reported it to Sales and to Clyde Weed in New York. Weed made a trip out to see what I was talking about, and I remember we stood at the edge of this one outcrop, and I showed him where the drill hole was located beyond towards the mountain, and I said, you know, Clyde, there are 2 miles between us and that mountain entirely covered, and I said, there could be a lot of copper under cover of that magnitude. And he said, yes, Ben, he said, that may be. But he said, what are you going to do about this river in back of you? The West Walker River was flowing within a few hundred yards of where we were standing. And he said, I can't imagine trying to mine with under a flow of water of that type. And I said, well, Clyde, modern equipment is such that